It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Let me tell you about my day yesterday. Before we even get to that, I don't want to forget, maybe you saw a clip of it or maybe you were watching SNL. Caitlin Clark was a guest and did a skit on Weekend Update, the gist of which was making fun of co-anchor Michael Che. At one point she said, you know, I'm known for hitting my three-pointers. I have 3 points for you, Michael. Be funnier, dumbass. Now, look, it was all scripted for her, of course, but she delivered the lines with pretty good comic timing. I mean, for somebody who's not, you know, usually making the rounds on TV. And I thought she did really well. And she just comes across as really likable. So I think, however she fares in the WNBA, she's going to be somebody who's going to be part of the, you know, media pop culture world. All right, now back to yesterday. First of all, hope you had a good weekend. And if you didn't get a chance to see Media Buzz, most of the segments are up now. So when I walked in early yesterday morning, the attacks on Israel by Iran had not only been finished the night before America, U.S. time, but were spectacularly unsuccessful. So the question was, I mean, this is a huge story, as I'll get to in a couple of moments. So the question was how much to do and whether we could salvage anything from the show we originally had planned. And the reason I wanted to do that was there were certain segments that I felt you wouldn't get this elsewhere or you wouldn't get a particular take elsewhere. Anyway, starting off with Trey Yingston, Israel, and using some of our more politically aligned guests, I mean, they were just so good at dealing with the political implications of the Iran attack, the thwarted Iran attack, I should say, what this would mean on Capitol Hill, and all of that. What we were able to still do was Donald Trump and abortion, not just the position that he announced earlier in the week, but of course, him coming out against the Arizona Supreme Court's resurrection of this 1864 law, which you've heard me talk about last week. And he was right out of the box saying, you know, this is going to be fixed. Except it may not be fixed because Republicans immediately adjourned the legislature and the Republican Speaker of the House says, I don't want to bring it up. We shall see. Secondly, the way in which the abominable legacy of O.J. Simpson changed the media world. You know, this television's addiction to exploitation of any trial that might get some ratings involving local people that you never heard of, but who were transformed into national melodramas. And I was really happy to discover as I was digging around live coverage of the Bronco chase, the infamous white Bronco chase, with Tom Brokaw, who was breaking into a playoff basketball game, which I was watching at the time. I was watching the Knicks. Suddenly, I see this white car going down the highway and Brokaw's unmistakable voice. And then this clip from Oprah in which she was sort of covering it live, even though by the time it aired, it had already happened. And you could hear, you know, a lot of the black people in Oprah's audience cheering and screaming. And then one woman said, justice has been done. I'm so happy for OJ and so forth. Despite the overwhelming evidence of his guilt in the double murder trial. And then finally, you know, I've talked a lot about the senior business editor, award-winning Yuri Berliner, and how he took on his own radio network in saying that it's gone from left-leaning to, you know, just huge, off the rails, in his phrase, liberal activism. Well, I had Juan Williams on, and back in 2010, Juan was dumped after a 10-year stint by National Public Radio. And he talked about that. And Juan said, yeah, you know, it's such an insulated cadre of liberal people who are so convinced they're right and going to convince you they're right that they have blind spots, they have arrogance. But he said in his case, despite the fact that he has, you know, that he is mostly a liberal voice on Fox News and that he has written best-selling books on the civil rights movement, he said, quote, I was too conservative a black guy for their taste. And I thought that was very telling. All right, let me slide right now into story number one. The first direct attack by Iran on the state of Israel. And it was unbelievably unsuccessful for several reasons. One is Israel is technologically superior, and so several of its anti-missile systems, the famous Iron Dome, but also something called Arrow, was able to intercept and blow up or deter 99% of the drones and rockets fired outside of Israeli airspace with help from U.S. forces as well as British and French forces. So this kind of exposed the fact that even though Iran used more sophisticated weapons than, say, Hamas does, and, you know, the significance of this is it's come out into the open. Everybody knows there wouldn't have been an October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas had Iran not been funding and advising and providing weaponry for that brutal attack. Everybody also knows that Iran is behind or is helping Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis and others. So this really was, I think, a spectacular failure for Iran and a huge win for Israel and a huge win for the United States, which after obviously a lot of rough patches over the handling of Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there, did exactly what President Biden said we would do. We would stand by Israel. We would defend Israel. And dozens of rockets were shot down by U.S. warplanes and ships. So, Washington Post saying this morning, senior administration official, we are ready to do it again if we have to. But this official said the United States would not participate in any offensive Israeli response against Iran. Quote, our aim is to de-escalate regional tensions because there's a huge risk here of a wider war. And as Trey Yinks told me from Israel, and as is apparent to everybody, Bibi Netanyahu now faces a huge decision. He can, as Biden told him in a phone call, take the win. You were able to not only defend yourselves, but I think humiliate Iran. Don't retaliate, because then you start this cycle of retaliation. Israel strikes back, then Iran strikes back again. More people get killed. Right now, Israel has, which sort of lost a lot of support in world opinion. Let's just face it, as the focus shifted more and more to the hunger crisis in Gaza, as well as civilian deaths in Gaza, as well as, you know, Hamas invites this because it embeds among its own people. So Biden said ironclad commitment to Israel's defense, and he proved it. And from Iran's point of view, this was retaliation for what Israel openly did in going into Syria and killing three top Iranian commanders. So here's Politico's take. Iran's attack on Israel was dangerous, provocative, and seemingly all but designed to fail. What was the point? The latest crisis to erupt in the region left many longtime analysts wondering what Iran's real intention was, whether the direct attack was mainly a face-saving exercise, which is what I believe, or a genuine effort to escalate. and whether the U.S. can still manage to prevent a full-scale regional war. So, you know, as you know, Israel had gone after the Iranian consulate in Damascus. And, you know, Iran had made a lot of noise about how Israel would be punished. But I think, now look, when you fire that many drones and missiles, you don't know. You don't know how successful Iron Dome or Arrow is going to be. So there could have been a lot more casualties. But I sort of have the strong feeling, given that some of the firepower is directed at an Israeli base causing minor damage, and certainly there were a bunch of injuries, including one involving a young child. But I kind of feel like Iran wanted to strike back, save face, but not escalate, that it doesn't want a direct confrontation with Israel, and that it certainly doesn't want a direct confrontation in the United States. Here is a man named Benham Ben Talabu, excuse me, senior fellow at the right-leaning Foundation for Defense of Democracies. There is a greater willingness to run risks by Iran than ever before. Until now, Iran had never directly targeted Israel in an overt and attributable fashion. The strike was also the first ballistic missile attack from Iranian territory against a defended target. Iran wanted to break the taboo of targeting Israeli territory. Well, yeah, enough of working through the proxies. This has been a shadow war, and now Iran has put it out in the open. It was a 7-year-old Bedouin Arab girl who was hospitalized. I mean, Iran even announced that this thing was over while some of its drones and missiles were still in the air. The drones took hours to reach Israel. Meanwhile, what about Capitol Hill? Mike Johnson, the speaker, saying on Maria Bartiromo's show yesterday that after that attack, the House will vote in the coming days on aid for Israel. He said, House Republicans, the Republican Party, understand the necessity of standing with Israel. We're going to try again this week. We're looking at options and supplement issues. He did sort of suggest that maybe Ukraine could be put into this bill as well. Look, you put this bill on the floor today, and it passes, at least as far as Israel. And Johnson seems willing to buck his own party. It might cost him his job. It might not. On aid to Ukraine. It is shameful that, and I'm not just blaming the Republicans, that petty partisan politics has held up America's ability for months now to aid our Israeli allies and to aid Ukraine in this unprovoked, brutal assault by Russia that also contains many of war crimes by Putin, lots of targeting of civilians. So there's some talk of, well, maybe because Trump has come out for this, maybe the aid to Ukraine could be packaged as a loan and not an outright gift. We can get some ammunition into the hands of the Ukrainians who are running out and increasingly cannot fire back against the Russians is fine with me. Maybe the loan gets forgiven. Maybe it doesn't. In any event.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Let's go on to number two. Today, you may have noticed, and already I'm seeing the shots of the Manhattan courthouse and Trump arriving any minute, the beginning of former President Donald Trump's first criminal trial. This is the Hush Money case, the Stormy Daniels case. And yes, I get it. It's absolutely historic. Not only is the first time a former president has been on trial, but it is, for all the weaknesses of this case, which I'll get into, a trial against a man who could be the next president. So Trump has been active on social media, saying on Truth Social, just 4 years ago, I was a very popular and successful president of the United States, getting more votes than any sitting president in history. That's true, but Joe Biden got more. Tomorrow morning, he's writing this yesterday, I'll be in criminal court before a totally conflicted judge, a corrupt prosecutor, a legal system in chaos, a state being overrun by violent crime and corruption, and crooked Joe Biden's henchmen rigging the system against his political opponent, me. I'd have to jump in and say, you can criticize DA Alvin Bragg all you want, and I have, but there is no evidence that Joe Biden is himself or his team is rigging the system. Here's more from the former president. As virtually every legal scholar has powerfully stated, the Biden-Manhattan witch hunt case is, among other things, barred by the statute of limitations. There was a question there, but the idea that every legal scholar virtually agrees with this is not true. The radical left Democrats are already cheating on the 2024 presidential election by bringing or helping to bring all these bogus lawsuits against me, forcing me to sit in courthouses and spend money that could be used for campaigning. I want my voice back. This crooked judge has gagged me. Unconstitutional. The other side can talk about me, but I am not allowed to talk about them. Rigged trial. Okay, there is a gag order, and it does supposedly, allegedly, ostensibly, prevent the 45th president from lashing out at witnesses, which he's done anyway, particularly Michael Cohen, and Stormy Daniels as well. And he obviously can defend himself in court, and he obviously can say whatever he wants along these lines. So it's not true that he can't defend himself at all. There is just certain restrictions on what he can say. So here's a piece that begins, New York Times, Donald Trump, having failed to fend off a criminal trial in Manhattan, said he plans to testify in the case stemming from a hush money payment to a porn star. I'm testifying. I tell the truth, he told reporters at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, all I can do is tell the truth. And the truth is there's no case. They have no case. A lot of people, let's just say, skeptical that he will actually take the stand. He has said in other cases that he would testify and then did not. He may not have made a final decision. When he was called to testify by the New York AG in the civil fraud case, it did not go well, and the judge found him liable for conspiring to inflate his net worth, another case that Trump dismisses. So what Alvin Bragg is charging is that Trump coordinated the hush money payment, $130,000, to Stormy Daniels toward the end of the 2016 election to keep her quiet. Also charged with falsifying documents to cover up these payments. Now, here's Rich Lowry at National Review, kind of taking the case apart with a little bit of sarcasm. Alvin Bragg is to be commended for getting to trial on the Trump hush payments case. Lesser prosecutors would have been daunted by the prospect of creating a national melodrama and a norm-breaking prosecution of a foreign president over what is, in essence, a misdemeanor business records charge. I can't argue with that. They would have blanched at having to rely on serial perjurer Michael Cohen as a star witness. Well, yes, that's true. They would have recognized the inherent ambiguity in the question of whether hush money payments to Stormy Daniels were personal payments or campaign expenses. They would have been reluctant to torture the law to stretch the statute of limitations just far enough to cover the events in question. That is why federal prosecutors and Bragg's predecessor, Cy Vance Jr., took a pass on the case. But Bragg is made of sterner stuff and wasn't going to let mere legal inadequacy prevent him from reaching for his destiny. About a month's time, he'll be known as the Manhattan DA who goes easy on disturbed men who punch old ladies on subway platforms. This is a thing, not just in New York, but I just do not understand. And it is horrible and frightening, and anybody who's caught should go to jail for a long time. but is hell on wheels on bookkeeping offenses that don't harm anyone. Now, the thing about this is what's starting today is jury selection. And I am told by certain plugged-in people that jury selection could last for several days, even a week. Nevertheless, you'll have correspondents and legal pundits filling the airtime day after day after day. I've sat through jury selection in a bunch of trials, and unless you're a real trial junkie, it is just not that exciting. It is crucial. I mean, obviously, if Trump's team can pick one or two jurors who aren't going to go along with this, they can get a mistrial, and then he doesn't even face the prospect of going to jail. But for the average person, and remember, there's no cameras in the courtroom, so we're just going to have people coming out and saying what happened, it's going to get pretty repetitive. Story three is about polls. There's a brand new New York Times Siena College poll. President Biden has nearly erased Donald Trump's early polling advantage. Amid signs, the Democratic base has begun to coalesce behind the president, despite lingering doubts about the direction of the country. Now, there's been enough of these polls for me to say that Biden has certainly closed much of the gap. I mean, almost all the polls month ago, let's just say before the State of the Union, he was behind 4, 5, 6, 7 points. And national polls are meaningless, so it all comes down to battleground states. But even in battleground states, Biden is gaining ground. And this is what the Biden camp had always predicted. They're now virtually tied nationally, says the Times. Trump 46, Biden 45. That is a statistical tie within the margin of error. In February, Trump had a 48-43% lead. Again, these are a national poll. Most states don't count because they're kind of predictable. Biden's tick upwards appeared to stem from his largely from his improved standing among traditional Democratic voters. He's winning a greater share of voters who supported him in 2020 than he did a month ago. At that time, Trump had 97% of Republican voters, or past Trump voters, I should say. Biden had 83. Now Biden has 89% compared to 94% for Trump. You know, the Biden theory has always been when it's not just Biden being held accountable for everything from inflation to the Mideast war, and Trump is seen more clearly as the alternative, that the polls would tighten. Nobody's disputing this. This will be a very close race. But you have other warning signs. Share of people who think the country's heading the wrong direction, 64%. 80% of voters rate the country's economic conditions as fair or poor, including a majority of Democrats. Both Biden and Trump remain unpopular. Most think Biden is too old. A majority believe Trump has committed serious federal crimes. And yet, only 1 in 4 voters said they were paying very close attention to the former president's legal travails. But that may change now with all of the, you know, saturation coverage that we're going to see in this Stormy Daniels case. Biden has inched up among Black and Latino voters, even though he's still significantly behind traditional levels of Democratic support, doing better in suburbs and among women. But, you know, the Black and Hispanic support, where Trump is much more competitive than you would expect a Republican to be. I mean, that could be the ballgame. If Biden cannot reignite further support among Black voters and have them turn out as opposed to stay home. Okay, 69%. Say Biden at 81 years old is too old to be an effective president. Trump turns 78 in a couple of months, but only 41% view him as too old. And here's a follow-up story about the views of Trump's presidency, which I think it may be part of the key to his comeback. Much more positive since he left office. While the memories haven't faded, many voters now have a rosier picture of his handling of the economy, immigration, maintaining law and order. Before the 2020 election, only 39% said the country was better off after Trump took office. Now, almost half say he improved things during his time as president. They recall the economic growth. They recall, in their view, strong national security. Many still remember him as a divisive and polarizing figure, low ratings on race relations and unifying the country. But 42%, this is fascinating, say Trump's presidency was mostly good for the country. Only 25% say the same about Biden, a horrible figure for an incumbent president. Nearly half say Biden's tenure has been mostly bad for the country. Now, we do, so here's Maya Garcia, 23 years old, former Trump hater. Now she says she's come to believe Trump's contentious style helped control crime and maintain order in the country. You know, sometimes we need that type of person in our lives, this woman says. So, just for a little perspective. George W. Bush, average approval rating while in office, 49%. Now, voters give him a 57% approval. Barack Obama, 15% bump after leaving the White House. So it's kind of typical. You remember the good things. The memories of the bad things kind of fade. You are reminded what you liked about the person in the first place.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Story number four, let's come back to Speaker Johnson. He went down to Mar-a-Lago on Friday, stood shoulder to shoulder with Donald Trump, who criticized the efforts to depose him, mostly by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And Marjorie Taylor Greene is a big Trump fan, and I think this will have an influence on her. Don't know for sure. He said, look, I'm sure Marjorie understands. She's a very good friend of mine, Trump said. I know she has a lot of respect for the speaker. He is about as good as you're going to do. So laying the praise on the speaker. In return for which, Mike Johnson promised to hold hearings on election integrity and mail-in ballots and all of that, which obviously is a big Trump issue. But the speaker's getting pulled in two directions. Green says his handling of Ukraine, and maybe this looks a little different after the bombardment of Israel, will affect her campaign, her effort, at least her professed effort, to kick him out of office. And some GOP centrists and some Senate Republicans are hopeful that the speaker can get Trump to go behind, to get behind an alternative approach to an aid bill that would help both Israel and Ukraine. And here's Trump saying at Mar-a-Lago that could be a loan rather than a gift, as I mentioned earlier. So Johnson has to get comfortable riding the Trump roller coaster, says this piece in Politico, because that's going to be part of his job, managing the former president and, if Trump wins, managing the future president. Of course, Trump has interjected himself before into congressional politics, killing that compromise that would have provided aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine, aid to Taiwan in exchange for tighter border security. Just blew it up. Number five, The Atlantic has a piece by Mark Leibovich on Gavin Newsom, who didn't particularly want to be profiled, but that's life. Newsom is well aware that lots of people think he's just dying to run for president. Shadow campaign, he calls it. Republicans are pointing it out, that he's been plotting a clandestine effort to supplant Biden as the nominee. Well, not now, I don't think. Newsom is clearly sensitive to this perception and eager to pursue it. He has spent months vouching for the president after a Republican debate at the Reagan Library on Fox News. And in other states, he delayed this interview for 2 months. Gavin Newsom doing that? And now the California governor, kind of a presidential super surrogate, a chief alleviator of fears about Biden, his age, his poll numbers. But being a super surrogate requires a certain performative humility That's not something that comes naturally to Gavin Newsom. You're good at this, Bill Maher told him when he appeared on his HBO show after Newsom just went off after the Republicans. Can you teach that speech to Biden, he said. Newsom chuckled awkwardly. He did the same when I recounted the exchange, I being Leibovich. His risk is that being so good at this can seem like he's running himself. Whenever he's asked about his presidential aspirations, Newsom pivots to his reverential spiel about Biden. He's doing things that I could never imagine him doing. Look, we all know that Gavin Newsom wants to be president and probably is setting himself up for 2028. And when I watched him in that debate moderated by Sean Hannity, he's pretty good. Now, that's leaving aside his record, California, all the left-wing programs there. That's a different subject. But it is interesting that Atlantic goes to interview Newsom, knowing full well he's just going to pivot and talk about Biden, but it's interesting anyway. And with that, I thank you for listening. Hope you had a good weekend again. Media Buzz segments online. We'll see you tomorrow with more Buzz Meter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
The Will Kane Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Kane as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.